Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has 2 limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
Hello and welcome back to Forma, a podcast featuring conversations with authors, teachers, creators, and leaders that are carefully contemplating the intersection of classical thought and contemporary culture, and the audio companion to FormaJournal.com. I am David Kern, an editor over at FormaJournal.com. For today's show, I spoke with Jeffrey Overstreet, who is a novelist and film critic who currently lives near Seattle, Washington, and teaches at Seattle Pacific University. And we chatted because over at FormaJournal.com, we are featuring a bunch of content featuring reflections on the life and work of Madeleine L'Engle, whose birthday was November 29th. So to celebrate this week over on the website, we have an interview with her biographer, Sarah Arthur, called The Enduring Legacy of Madeleine L'Engle. And you can find that over at FormaJournal.com. We're going to have this conversation with Jeffrey Overstreet. We have an essay coming up on her YA fiction, as well as a number of other things that will be featured on the website. But today, for this episode of the podcast, I wanted to sit down with Jeffrey Overstreet because he has been an outspoken fan of Madeleine L'Engle's work. As I said, Jeffrey teaches over at Seattle Pacific University, where he teaches film studies and creative writing. He has also written 4 acclaimed fantasy novels, including Aurelia's Colors and The Aleboys Feast, which were both published by Random House and are available wherever books are sold. He also has a movie-going memoir called Through a Screen Darkly, and his award-winning arts writing has been published in places like Image, Paste, Christianity Today, Books and Culture, and many other magazines and websites. To learn more about Jeffrey, you can head over to lookingcloser.org, where he blogs about music, film, and other arts. I'm a huge fan of Jeffrey Overstreet. When I was in college, he was a big resource to me when I was studying film and creative writing, and he was quite inspiring to me. So this is a fun treat for me to be able to chat with him about one of our mutual favorites, Madeleine L'Engle. We chatted a lot about her book, Walking on Water, which Jeffrey is particularly fond of, as well as a little bit about her fiction series, which begins with A Wrinkle in Time. And with that, I will kick it right over to my interview with Jeffrey Overstreet about Madeleine L'Engle. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you on the other side. Where did you first discover Madeleine L'Engle, and how did you, I guess, fall in love with her work?
Well, I attended a private Christian school in Portland, Oregon, kindergarten through high school, with the same same small class of students and a small community of teachers. And that community was very focused on anything labeled Christian. And so I spent a lot of time in Christian bookstores and loving fairy tales and Disney stuff when I was a kid. I gravitated to anything that was fantasy focused. And there wasn't much of that in Christian bookstores. There was Tolkien, there was Lewis. If it was an outstanding Christian bookstore, there was Charles Williams.
There was
Madeline L'Engle. Right. Exactly. Exactly. The Inklings. And, except for some really, really, you know, preachy allegorical, retellings of Pilgrim's Progress or whatever, which was heavily allegorical to begin with. So Madeline L'Engle, got my attention there. I was not immediately drawn to her work because I was much more into fantasy and didn't want to read about other kids and their troubles at school because that world seemed so different than my school and my friends. And I wasn't particularly interested in science, and she very much was. So I don't remember loving A Wrinkle in Time as a kid. What made a big difference to me was when I was a senior in high school and my English teacher, Michael Demkiewicz, gave me a copy of Walking on Water, Reflections on Faith and Art. And if I had to point to three or four books that have really changed my life, I mean, that would be among them. I probably have six or seven copies of it, and they're all underlined to the point that I couldn't possibly hand them off to somebody. That was a book that really gave me permission to dedicate my life to writing creatively as a Christian, and to trust my imagination, to trust the ideas that were intriguing to me, believing that the truth would reveal itself within the work and within the inspiration, rather than having to fashion my imaginative endeavors to deliver the truth to an audience. And when I look back at my own creative writing as a child, so many of my early stories were obviously burdened with this sense that I had to be a missionary. And so there were good Christian characters and evil non-Christian characters, and the good Christian characters always won. But I got bored with that pretty quickly. And reading Walking on Water was so liberating to believe that if you love story, if you love characters, and if you love truth, then you're going to know a good story when you find it. And you don't have to then sort of co-opt it or give it an infusion of Christianity, but anything beautiful and true is the stuff of God. And that has shaped my life, not just in my creative writing, but in the way I enthusiastically pursue all kinds of art and the way now that I teach. So I think that first profound encounter was that first reading of Walking on Water and the countless rereadings since then. Then when I arrived at Seattle Pacific University as a freshman in 1989, I can't remember if it was 1990. I think it was that she came and spoke here. And that was, that was one of those moments where I look back and I'm like, I knew that this was one of those moments in my life that I was going to get to meet her and thank her for that. I'm holding the copy of Walking on Water that she signed during that visit. And she was every bit as joyful and funny and alive as I would have imagined. I'll never forget that.
How do those characteristics of hers that you just described there, that joyfulness and that sense of being alive, how do those characteristics manifest themselves in her work?
There is there is an enthusiastic and fearless engagement with what is in front of her, as opposed to what I've seen so often in quote unquote Christian literature or Christian art, which again is burdened by that sense of we have to get good results from this. She would plunge into whatever the latest science was. You know, she was fascinated with quantum physics because she knew that if you explored those questions with your metal detector seeking truth, it was going to lead you to God. And if those discoveries seemed to contradict the common knowledge of the church, then maybe it was time for the church to be ready to receive a new, or at least a larger, word from God, that God was not going to plant things in his own creation to contradict himself, to test us whether we really believed his word or not. And while I never did become an enthusiastic student of science, I got to say these days I value it more than maybe I did in school. Maybe I should have taken it more seriously. But as I focus with my students now on writing solid arguments and seeking evidence that backs up those claims, I can hear Madeline in the back of my mind saying, you know, don't follow the truth, follow what is verifiable, follow what holds up under scrutiny, because you will find that that is harmonious with the word of God. And if it doesn't seem to be, then you really need to look at both the science and your understanding of the word of God and see which one may be a little too narrow or a little misguided. So anyway, all that back to your question, I think the joy was in the faith, and the faith was in the truth will win out. Love will win out. Mercy will win out. And I think she would have been delighted by recent science that shows that scientists are learning more and more that they can trust what is beautiful. That if a solution presents itself or a concept presents itself and it seems beautiful, then that means it has integrity. If it has integrity, then it's going to hold up under scrutiny. And that means we can pursue beauty and trust that it will be synonymous with logos. That was the word she liked, with truth. So
you mentioned that she in some ways has informed the way that you teach, or maybe I can't remember if you said it that way exactly. I don't think so, but can you explain how she has inspired your interactions with your students? I mean, you mentioned that about the way you kind of help your students pursue an argument, but how does what she taught you as far as that joy in the faith, and how does that manifest itself for you in the classroom? Many of our listeners are teachers themselves, and that's kind of a everlasting pursuit, right? How do you manifest those sorts of things or embody those sorts of things for your students? Have you thought about that at all, and how she's inspired that for you?
Yeah, quite a bit, actually. It depends on the class. If I'm teaching a creative writing class, then I'm thinking about where Madeline, I'm thinking about her approach to creative work as a sort of collaboration, that when you pursue questions of what if, that the work knows more than you do. And that, let's see, I have a line from her here. She writes, "Over the years, I have come to recognize that the work often knows more than I do. And with each book I start, I have hopes that I may be helped to serve it a little more fully." I often get that sense when I'm writing, that, you know, maybe something isn't working or I'm not pleased with it, but then I share it in a workshop and somebody says, "Well, what I hear going on in there is this," and I just sit there thunderstruck. It's my favorite moment when I am interviewing an artist, whether that's a filmmaker or a musician, and I say, you know, "Well, I love how you have this going on in your work." And they sort of blink and go, "You know, I've never thought of it that way before." But if you are trusting that inclination toward beauty, and you follow what dear old Gandalf would have said rings true, then the work is saying more than you know. And I think that models sort of the example given us by Christ in storytelling, that when he shared a parable, he was reluctant to interpret it for us, that he kept it grounded in common storytelling about common people without labeling anything as religious or Christian. And of course the term didn't exist at the time, but trusted listeners to think about choices and consequences, and that that would speak in many different ways to many different readers, not contradictory ways necessarily, but that we all come to art with different experiences, different fears, different vantage points, different opinions, and that's going to enable us to see different aspects of truth within a work of art, sort of the way different mountain climbers will have entirely different experiences on a mountain, but that doesn't mean they're not all learning about the learning real things about the same mountain. So when I teach creative writing students, we talk a lot about, you know, trust, stay focused on your characters and on the story. Don't worry about what it means, because when you step back from the story at the end, the art knows more than you do, and you may be surprised by what your story ends up being about. I also encourage them to develop rich vocabularies and keep reading stuff that's harder than what they might typically enjoy, because Madeline emphasized that the more words we know, the better we can think, that words come first. As you learn words, you develop more complicated ways of thinking and perceiving and interpreting things. And I think a lot of the challenges I'm finding in my creative writing classes right now is that students aren't reading literature. They're reading a lot, but they're reading it on they're reading social media, which has a very limited vocabulary.
We don't really use words on social media. Pictures and abbreviations
and emojis, exactly. And then in other classes, like in my faith and film class, when we're sort of doing a film survey of films from around the world and from different eras, I will talk about how Madeline did not limit herself to finding truth within Christian thought, that she was enthusiastic about reading Buddhist writers, that she was enthusiastic about reading the Quran, because she believed that God is at work within anyone made in his image, and that all traditions that are seeking truth probably capture some of it. And so long as it does not contradict the revelations of Christ, we should anticipate, I mean, even by the instruction of our own scriptures, we should anticipate that the invisible things of God from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood through what has been made. So they are without excuse. That anyone earnestly seeking truth within any tradition may discover it in a way that will benefit everyone. And so while she insisted that she was not a universalist in her book, Walking on Water, she also refused to limit herself and to say where God may or may not actually be working and speaking. Mm. And I think that's valuable for any kind of course. You know, I have film students who don't want to watch films that are in other languages because they just don't see them as relevant. And they're missing out on so much just because they don't want to read subtitles. Mm-hmm. And I think this goes for other genres and neglected aspects of our own Bible that have things to reveal to us. But they're going to take work to learn to read within their genre and interpret them properly.
Mm. Would you say that she helped sort of form or give guidance for you on how to kind of approach that work, that work of, you know, reading carefully and being aware of what's not on the surface, and kind of being gracious in your approach to the way people wrote? Is that something that you think she, I guess, I don't know how else to put it, besides that she kind of gave you guidance on in her work?
I think it's by example. I mean, just the wide range of texts that she would enthusiastically quote. One of the first encounters I had with her was in a book called Reality and the Vision that was published by the Chrysostom Society, where different Christian writers wrote about the writers who most inspired them. And in this book, Philip Yancey writes about John Donne. Stephen Lawhead writes about J.R.R. Tolkien. Eugene Peterson writes about Dostoevsky. And Madeline Mengel writes about George MacDonald. And that led me to read George MacDonald for the first time. But she loved his vision of how God speaks. I have here on my wall in a little frame a quote from George MacDonald that I discovered thanks to Madeline Lingle. He says, "When we understand the outside of things, we think we have them. Yet the Lord puts his things in subdefined, suggestive shapes, yielding no satisfactory meaning to the mere intellect, but unfolding themselves to the conscience and the heart." And right away, that sounds like the experience I have reading the Inklings, reading Lengel, but also now reading science and seeing that God does not create a tree and then tell us what it means. He creates a living word that goes on speaking every day in different ways to anyone who approaches it. And these things are not easy to explain. We have to reach for metaphors. We have to reach for poetry in order to sort of cast a net around the mysterious revelation of that particular word of God. And that seems to be the way she approached, taught us to approach science through her novels, through A Wrinkle in Time, and especially the second one, A Wind in the Door, which is not, I don't enjoy that book as much as I do A Wrinkle in Time. But I do, I am impressed with how she takes her characters into subatomic experiences and brings to life these complex scientific concepts so that even children can read about them and see that this isn't just about chemistry or whatever. This is an illustration of the cosmos that God has made, that what is happening within the atom is what's happening within the universe. And that these things have voices. You can actually dialogue with them. And that sounds like fairy tales, but I think she has taught me to approach the natural world and my own body in different ways so that I see that everything is a language. You can't separate what is sacred and what is secular, just as you can't separate what is spiritual and what is physical. It's all a language. And you have to tune your ears to listen for what is really being said to the conscience and the heart, in George MacDonald's words, as you're studying the information. So that just inclines me to be open to revelation anywhere. And I'm grateful to her for that.
Have you had any pushback from your students at, you know, at a Christian university where you're kind of sharing some of these ideas from Lengel, the kind of ideas that would get her accused of being a universalist, which, as you said, she kind of denied was true. But have you felt or have you heard pushback from students at that school?
I actually have not the way I anticipated, but that's because I grew up in Christian education during a very different time. The Christian education institutions that I knew growing up were much more wary. There was a lot of pushback. There were very few films were allowed to be screened on campus in any official way when I was an undergraduate at Seattle Pacific. You know, and now we have film classes where we're watching all kinds of things. Only certain kinds of music were allowed at school functions when I was in a Christian high school. And I remember in elementary school looking at classics of American literature in the school library and finding the whole lines had been blacked out with Sharpies because they were afraid the students would be corrupted by reading rough language or evidence of unhealthy perspectives on the world. And now the students I find coming in, even those from more conservative Christian traditions, are so immersed in pop culture that I think they know the value of these things, that I see a lot of eye rolling when I refer to those traditions that would censor or that would say certain areas of imaginative endeavor are off limits to us, because they've had those experiences already with popular music. And they also cringe at the idea of co-opting what is good and what is beautiful, and, you know, trying to force it into some preachy message delivery service, so to speak. I love what Madeline wrote about the St. Matthew Passion. She said, the St. Matthew Passion is an icon of the highest quality for me, an open door into the realm of the numinous. Bach, of course, was a man of deep and profound religious faith, a faith which shines through his most secular music. As a matter of fact, the melody of his moving chorale, O Sacred Head Now Wounded, was the melody of a popular street song of the day, but Bach's religious genius was so great that it is now recognized as one of the most superb pieces of religious music ever written. There is nothing so secular that it cannot be sacred, and that is one of the deepest messages of the Incarnation. Mm-hmm. And I will read that, and then my film class will watch a Woody Allen movie, of all things, from 1989. And they will cringe at some of the attitudes, but they will also see that in, say, Crimes and Misdemeanors, characters make decisions that lead to devastating consequences. And those decisions are driven by a sense of amorality. And so then we have really interesting discussions about how, once again, the work knows more than the artist. The artist is embracing and publicly preaching a message of amorality, but his movie is showing that there are deep, troubling questions in his own imagination about characters who live that way. And it creates a wonderful forum for thinking about how, when you try to create something relevant or beautiful and it strays off the course of truth, then it falls apart. But you can insist on a godless world until you're blue in the face. And if you make something that's beautiful, it's going to contradict you on that point. So that Madeline comes in very handy there by saying, look, anything that is beautiful cannot be secular.
So on a related note, we have another podcast called Close Reads, and we go through various novels at a pretty leisurely pace, reading a few chapters at a time and discussing them. And we've got a Facebook group of people that are listening and, you know, adding to the conversation there. And so right now we just started reading The Great Gatsby.
Oh, wow.
And so there's been a debate there about what role a book like The Great Gatsby should play, you know, in, say, a Christian home or a Christian high school, for example. And mm-hmm. so one of the discussion's kind of been drawn along some of the predictable lines, but the discussion has kind of turned on the idea of at what point should, or to what degree should we be reading stories that you might call, loosely you might call cautionary tales, where they're sort of diagnosing a problem and, you know, sort of revealing the truth about a culture by doing that, and
sure, sort
of offering us warnings as The Great Gatsby does, as opposed to prioritizing stories where there may be models of virtue that can be worth imitating, you know, like types of, you know, what we would call types. So where do you think Madeline L'Engle would fall in that discussion in terms of the value of the sort of cautionary tale that diagnoses a problem and, you know, is valuable because it does that, as opposed to the story that offers a model that's worth imitating? And what would she say about what we should offer to young people in particular, do you think?
I think, well, she talks a lot about the importance of maintaining that childlike faith. She refused to, I love this, she refused to refer to herself as just the age that she is now. She, I don't have the quote in front of me, but she says, you know, I am also 5 and 8 and 14 and 32. so sort of like age is, you know, being the rings of a tree. You are more and more all the time. You didn't leave something behind. And she talks about writing about truth to children, because often that's the only way to get through to adults. Sometimes I think Pixar Studios takes the same approach. They're really making movies for the parents, right? But when you see the promotional materials, it's all aimed at kids. And then you get there and it's the concepts are profound for everyone. I think that A Wrinkle in Time, as a good example, takes us to some really horrifying places. I mean, you see the dangers of certain philosophies, the dangers of certain societal models, the dangers of conformity. And you have, I'm reluctant to say a hero, because Meg is very flawed in the book. I mean, her emotions are very mercurial. She makes big mistakes. She acts very rashly, and there are consequences for those actions. But in some moments where it counts, and this is a very Tolkien thing too, where there is a prioritization of love and grace, then there is sort of this answering force of love and grace that's even greater than what the quote-unquote hero is doing. And so Meg becomes a wonderful model rather than a hero in that she collaborates with that greater force of love. And so we don't come away from A Wrinkle in Time looking to her as some great hero the way a lot of the world's myths and legends, sort of valorize or celebrate the hero model. But she's more inclined to embrace holy fools and saints, people who make major mistakes, but because they have faith, great reconciliation and healing and goodness is able to pour into the world through those broken vessels. So I think that she pushes back against the model that a lot of Christian storytelling wanted, as I remember it growing up, which was we need great stories about very good people who do the right thing.
Right.
And instead say, well, what are the models in Scripture? I mean, the quote unquote heroes of the faith are ridiculous when you look at them closely and prone to spectacular error. And they become occasions for the grace of God. Lauren Winter has spoken about this too, about how stories of saints are much more valuable to us than stories of heroes. And I think that's very true. So having said that, if you're looking at something like The Great Gatsby, you're looking at a story full of really messed up people zigzagging their way toward something good, and often zigging far more than they zag, so to speak, pursuing a good thing, but in the wrong way. And then that gets complicated, of course, with other interpretations of that story. The recent movie of The Great Gatsby was one of those occasions where I had to say, okay, the story points us in this direction, but what does this movie love? Mm-hmm. The movie loves music. That's great. The movie loves visual beauty. That's great. But it also loves money. That movie loves money. And so now I think it's even harder to teach The Great Gatsby if the students have that reference point, because you have to pull them out of that, where so much of what's happening on the screen is about glitz and glamour, and focus on what gets priority of place in the book, which is characters and decisions and consequences. I think a book like The Great Gatsby teaches us to be more honest about ourselves, but also to be more compassionate toward those that we would like to write off as monsters. I think Gatsby's a good book for us right now. There are a lot of people with a lot of money doing a lot of horrible things. And The Great Gatsby makes us ask, what are they longing for? I mean, they're going about it maybe all the wrong ways, but what is it they want at the heart of things? What troubles have they experienced that make them pursue some kind of resolution in this way? And that can make us more empathetic and more merciful in the long run. And we're right back to, Bilbo and Frodo with Gollum. That the real triumph of the Lord of the Rings is not the destruction of an enemy, but the mercy and the patience shown toward a monster and the understanding of where he came from and what happened in his life.
You mentioned that you were not inclined necessarily to call Meg a hero. But I was struck by the fact that even if she's not sort of that traditional archetypal hero that you mentioned, she's also not really an anti-hero the way we sort of think about it. She's not like a Don Draper anti-hero at the same time.
No. No, she really is. I mean, her compass does ultimately settle on love. But part of that is that she's experienced it. I mean, the Murray family is a rare and wonderful thing in literature. You have a loving father, if slightly misguided, although the movie makes him much more misguided, I think. You have a loving mother. You have siblings that support each other. you know, that's a rare thing. I mean, outside of the Incredibles. And
it's true. Yeah.
So she has models herself that help her keep that compass in tune. It's ironic I'm using the metaphor of the compass because there, of course, is another fantasy epic that is written in answer to Narnia, so to speak, that really botches the idea of a moral compass. But also, yeah. I think Meg is an important flawed hero, as any good hero is, in that she is so unique in the literature of the time. There were no major, that I can think of, no major fantasy stories or science fiction stories that had a young girl as a hero. And one that is not, you know, beautiful, looking for just the right boyfriend, but who is loved by a rather idealized boyfriend, I think, if we're honest, in spite of that she, she's kind of a nerd. And when the movie of The Wrinkle in Time, opened recently, I had no gripe whatsoever with the idea of this multiracial family representing the Murrays, because I thought that was very true, in a sense, to what Madeline wanted us to think about, which was you can be different in your class or in your community, and that can make you feel alienated, but that does not mean you have anything less to contribute. In fact, maybe you have something more to contribute because you are unique. And so, I heard some people criticizing the movie as just being politically correct by having an African-American Meg Murray. I think Madeline would have loved that. I think that was very true to the themes of the story. Calvin, on the other hand, I do have a problem with. I don't he's sort of like a wish fulfillment boyfriend for Meg. Maybe that's Madeline giving her character what she wishes she had when she was young. I don't know.
What did you think of the movie overall, though? I've read some of your reviews, but maybe we should just point people to your reviews on.
I actually don't think I have written a proper review of that film. I came away with so many mixed feelings that I thought, if I sit down to write about this movie, it's going to take hours and hours and hours, and I just haven't had that. But I felt like the conversations about the film went there anyway, to this sense that it honors some, if not most, of the themes of the story. It's almost everybody agrees that the cast is very strong, that the scenes with Meg and her father are particularly strong, but that it sort of succumbs to pop culture platitudes in places of the more profound gospel of the story. There are places, I mean, it's not a particularly preachy Christian story, but there are places where she has her characters who are talking about all kinds of philosophers and famous figures, where whenever Jesus is mentioned, it's a very profound observation and moment that really connects to what's going on in the story. The movie took all of that out and replaced references to Jesus with references to Lin-Manuel Miranda, which has me shaking my head. I mean, I might have been okay.
Interesting choice.
Yeah, I might have been okay with a reference to Hamilton in the movie, considering the characters and the reimagining of the story. But to replace the teachings of Jesus with that just felt like, come on. I don't understand that at all. And then you have to be willing to accept a 50-foot Oprah, which is, you know, that kind of jostled my suspension of disbelief.
When did you discover her fiction? Because you mentioned that you first discovered her through Walking on Water. When did her fiction become something that you turned to?
Well, my wife and I reread A Wrinkle in Time just before the movie came out, and I remembered that. But then when we went on to A Wind in the Door, I had to admit a few chapters in that I didn't remember this at all. So I don't know that I read the whole trilogy as a kid. I think I read A Wrinkle in Time out of a sense of responsibility. It was so acclaimed. And then it had that added appeal of being a banned book, right? I mean, that book has been banned and is still attacked by Christians who apparently haven't read it as being satanic or whatever. They don't like the fact that there are witches in it. And I just read the story and you'll find out that they're not witches, that they dress up like witches because they think that's funny. When you find out what they really are, you might feel a little stupid about.
So you're saying you should actually read the book before you judge it?
I know that's a controversial view.
I guess you'd have to read more than 240 characters. Is it 240 now? 280 characters?
200. I think it's 240. I don't know.
Something like that.
Anyway, I think I probably read the full novel for the first time in high school. But she didn't mean that much to me then. It wasn't until I'd read Walking on Water that vision was so, so transforming, so liberating for me, so meaningful to me, that then I wanted to go back to the story and see how that was at work in the story. So I read the book, I read the novel more as a how-to, more as a, so how, you know, how are these principles at work in this storytelling, which is so backwards from the way I fell in love with so many other stories, where it was the characters and the world building that enchanted me. I mean, I still favor The Lord of the Rings over Narnia, because that is a world that I completely believe in when I'm reading it. Whereas when I'm reading Narnia, for all of Lewis's insistence that it's not an allegory, I feel like so many characters come with this sort of footnote about what worldview or what famous person they represent, or what part of the gospel algebra they are illustrating.
Yeah. So you got to, when you were really sort of reading Lengel closely, you were thinking in terms of the craft itself, it was less about kind of being swept away by the world by the time you got to it, and more about what is she doing to create this, and how is she kind of imbuing it with the things she's trying to say and the truth that she's after.
Yes. Yes. And I think even early on, I was thinking, boy, she really needed an editor. It's funny. I read things now that I loved as a kid, and I think, wow, I would have marked this up if I received it in class. There are, in A Wind in the Door especially, there are scenes that are so dialogue heavy, and the dialogue will be these solid paragraphs that run for pages, where you can tell that she's just so excited about this concept, about bringing this scientific concept to life. She's so excited about how she is impersonating forces that the story can really drag at points, at least for me. But it's the spirit of the thing that I love. It's that enthusiasm to enable the created world to speak in a way that children will hear and understand, sort of the way Tolkien felt so deeply for the trees that were being cut down near his home, that he gave the Ents voices in The Lord of the Rings.
Well, I know you need to get going, so I have two kind of, well, I guess two hopefully quick questions for you as we wrap up. One is, when it comes to the Wrinkle in Time series, for people who may have not had their kids reading it or never read the books themselves, either because of reputation or because someone recommended they not, when would you recommend that they start? I realize that's a kind of impossible question, given that you don't know the students that we're talking about here. But generally speaking, when would you say is a safe time to begin considering it, either for, you know, reading at home or for, you know, reading in school?
Well, when I wrote Aurelius Colors, I was writing that as a fantasy novel for adults, and I have received more letters from 10-year-old girls than from grown-ups. So I find that I always underestimate what kids who love reading are ready for. I first read Watership Down when I was 10, and I read it over and over and over after that. And I've heard so many parents have been horrified by that, thinking no one should read Watership Down until they're an adult, because that is a horrifying book about war. And, you know, yeah, they're bunny rabbits, but they're tearing each other to pieces. And that, I almost said pizzas. That would be a strange story. I'm inclined to say that A Wrinkle in Time is ready for 10-year-olds.
Because there's never been a 9-year-old boy who was outside playing with his brother, playing like army or pretending he was like a wolf attacking a bear or something. That's never happened before.
Well, and I think her manifestation of magical characters is still strikes me as so distinct. Mrs. Witch or and any of the three in A Wrinkle in Time, but then later in the series, the way she manifests angels is absolutely psychedelic, and truer to the description of cherubim in the scriptures than anything I've found in fantasy. They're terrifying and confusing, and have eyes all over the place, and they have wings all over the place. They don't look like the guys from Wings of Desire, and they don't look like the woman touched by an angel. And you are encountering something that is profoundly other in those books, and at the same time, those entities are interested in human beings as a unique word of God. And so I think kids would find that baffling and strange and different than so much fantasy that is just at this point derivative of derivative rehashes of the Lord of the Rings. But also I think with so much conversation in culture right now about the importance of science and the value of science and the importance of countering fake news with real research and real evidence. I think Madeline is a great science fiction writer for kids today because she makes science, I think, more appealing than it was to me in school and the way it was taught in school. It seems, for lack of a better word, magical or enchanted or spiritual, transcendent, than just information, which is how it felt to me in school.
She's embodying something deeper at the heart of it.
Right. Absolutely. I wish I had read A Wrinkle in Time when I was 8 and really gotten into it. And I would recommend it for kids that age. But I would also really recommend it as family reading. There's not a lot of that going around anymore, but families that read together give children the chance to to show the parents what they're seeing in the story, but also the experience of hearing different perspectives and interpretations of a story. My primary misgiving about movies becoming the dominant form of storytelling or television becoming the dominant form of storytelling is that we experience it in solitude most of the time. Mm-hmm. Or if we watch it with somebody else, then we just flip the channel and go on to the next thing. We don't sit and talk about it. And these books are a great opportunity to sit and experience something together, talk about it, and then revisit it later to see what else it has to say.
Mm. One of the things I love about reading with kids or even watching movies with kids, maybe this is less true of watching movies, but kids just want to talk about the stuff that they just experienced,
absolutely.
Their instinct is to tell us what they loved and ask questions about it. And I feel like one big major problem is that we sort of tend to discourage that for some reason. Just, I don't know if it's a cultural thing or, but for whatever reason they lose that. And I don't know if, or we lose that, I suppose. I don't know if it's because we decide we're too cool to talk about it anymore or something happens as we become adolescents. But I know my own kids, I've got a 7-year-old, 6-year-old, when they read something, they're talking about it for days and days, if they really love it, especially. And that's one of those things that I've been thinking a lot about. How do we preserve that?
There's more information all the time about suicide and how young people who consider or commit suicide, you can often trace their despair back to whether they felt like they had a safe place to play as a child and that it was safe to ask questions. If they feel safe, they develop these muscles of being able to imagine ways around or through a problem. And if they are discouraged from asking questions and from playing what if and from role playing and from fantasy, from make believe, then when they are confronted with problems, they don't have the experience and the vision to imagine that this problem is not everything. I remember Newsweek published a study several years ago that said preschool children on average ask their parents 100 questions a day. And
it seems low.
Yeah, maybe. And then they said by middle school, they've pretty much stopped asking. And it's no coincidence. I'm quoting now this article. It's no coincidence that this same time is when student motivation and engagement plummet. They didn't stop asking questions because they lost interest. It's the other way around. They lost interest because they stopped asking questions. And you have to find out why, who discouraged them, within Christian communities and contexts like that, you have to wonder if there comes a point where the voices of authority start discouraging questions because they don't know how to reconcile what's going on in the world with what they are teaching in church. And that's where Madeline steps up and says, bring it on. You know, let's talk about what's happening in the world. And if our faith has no answer for that, then maybe we need to go back to the scriptures and see if we have given up too early on these questions.
Well, with that, I'll let you go. I think that's a great place to end. And I know you have to go to a meeting, so I will let you do that. But thanks for spending some time with me and for chatting with me about Madeline L'Engle.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I'm happy to celebrate her any day of the week. So we can do this again sometime.
All right. Thank perfect. You. Sounds good.
Thank you for providing this opportunity to celebrate her. That's great.
No, of course. Thank you for being part of it.
Well, thanks again to Jeffrey Overstreet for joining me for this conversation about Madeline L'Engle. For more of our coverage on Madeline L'Engle's life and her work, head over to formajournal.com. And don't forget that if you want more from Jeffrey Overstreet, such as his writing on film and music, you can head over to lookingcloser.org. Well, that's it for this episode of the podcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.